I read all the best Bitcoin content out there so that you can listen. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read with Guy Swan. This is going to be great timing that we are finally getting to this piece. This will be the last piece in the Bitcoin Times second edition. And it's by Alexander Svetsky, the organizer and founder of all of this. And we've had him on the show. I'll actually try to remember to put in the show notes the conversation that we had with him. Alex is great, unapologetic, always has fun stuff. So I highly, highly encourage that. But just yesterday, The Sovereign Individual, the audiobook for The Sovereign Individual was released, and it is perfectly in line with the topic. So I'll go ahead and just shill that out too. If you've not read The Sovereign Individual, it is one of those books with just amazing foresight and perspective on how our future is likely to play out. But we are going to be reading Alexander Svetsky's article today, and let's go ahead and jump in. It is titled "The Rise of the Individual: The Fall of the State." Quote, "The greatest danger to the state is independent intellectual criticism." End quote. Murray Rothbard. Dedicated to those who stood up to tyranny. Today, the people of Hong Kong. Tomorrow, all of us. Why does Bitcoin matter? I wrote an article on Hacker Noon about a year ago now, which is entitled "Why Bitcoin Matters." I explored Bitcoin from first principles, starting with an examination of the societal stack, money's role in society, how it evolved over time, its fundamental attributes and functions, and finally culminating into an analysis of why Bitcoin is superior both as a monetary unit and a monetary network, aka a monetary operating system. For this piece, I'd like to take a more, perhaps, revolutionary approach to why Bitcoin matters. It's that thing which the protagonist, Winston Smith, of Orwell's seminal piece, 1984, was unknowingly calling out for and inherently describing whilst O'Brien was torturing him. The, quote, "force of good that exists in all humans, and the desire for freedom was and always will be there. But a tool via which it could manifest in spite of the oppressive power of an authoritarian state just did not and could not exist at the time. But it's no longer 1984. Times have changed. Bitcoin matters because Bitcoin is a tool. It's what we, the revolutionaries, have been missing this entire time. We had the human spirit. We had the will. We knew there was something wrong, but we lacked the tool with which to stand up to Big Brother. Bitcoin is that tool. Whilst getting rich because you're in the game early is cool and all, greed drives me as much as it does the next person, it's this revolutionary aspect of Bitcoin that should get you most excited about its prospects. Not since the gunpowder revolution were ordinary men and women able to stand up to those who chose to oppress or rule them unjustly. Only this time, it can be done in a non-violent method, whereby one can peacefully opt out, as John Galt and the men of the mind did in Atlas Shrugged. This, above all else, is why Bitcoin matters, and why the legend of Satoshi will go down in history as the most profound story since the beginning of time, or whichever significant religious event or story you'd like to reference instead. This fact also just reinforces why megalomaniacs like Craig Wright and his band of deranged Kool-Aid-drinking followers are simply the antithesis to Satoshi and Bitcoin. Revolutionaries and renegades. Bitcoin is the stand we take this decade, this century, this millennium. Bitcoin is the tool we use to separate money and state. Bitcoin is the lightning rod that will bring together the renegades and the revolutionaries. Bitcoin is of and for the liberators, the missionaries, and the visionaries. The men and women who won't accept suppression, oppression, or the dictates of a world in which we're subjugated to the whims of central planners, bureaucrats, rent seekers, attention whores, corrupt politicians, crooked bankers, backdoor dealers, creeping socialism, and crony capitalism. There has never been a tool so incorruptible, yet so inherently powerful and accessible. With it, we can reimagine the state. We will transform society. We will redefine the very essence of what it means to be a modern, collaborative human. Have I gone off the deep end? Of course. But there's an entirely new world over here, and at some point, I know you'll join me. May this essay be a start. The separation of money and state. Make no mistake about it. This century will be defined by the separation of money and state. It has already started, and nothing can stop it. It's inevitable, assuming, of course, we plan on surviving. The alternative is a parasitic dystopian future in which society feeds on itself until it collapses. So, if we err on the side of humanity's continuation, we must be honest with ourselves and realize a paradigm shift is nigh. Even Ray Dalio is coming around. He's just missing the word Bitcoin from his most recent articles. Although I would guess that's a wise move in his shoes, for if he mentions it in a positive light, it may cause a stampede and drive the goddamn price up to $1 million a coin prematurely and fuck up the stock-to-flow model. Furthermore, it will mean my shitty fiat will buy less Bitcoin, and we can't have that. Yet. So, Ray, if you're reading this, keep buying Bitcoin privately, please. Back to separating money and state. The paradigm is shifting. Economically, politically, technologically, socially, ethically, and in every other way imaginable. Davidson and Rees-Mogg, in their seminal pre-2000 work, The Sovereign Individual, posited that this shift started in the 90s, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of communism, and the beginning of the information age. I would tend to agree with them. Communism was the peak of the parasitic, centralized state, at least measured in terms of brute violence and broad incompetence. The crony capitalism and quasi-socialism we in the West live with today are very much improvements on the communism of the USSR, and to some degree so is the communism in China, thanks to the benefits of capitalism that helped enrich their rulers. But the inherent concentration of the unit through which society is measured, i.e. money, has led us to a point of diminishing returns, where peak stupidity, peak stimulus, and peak economic distortion mean the government, aka the state, can no longer squeeze more out of the system and has begun to feed on itself. Note that I omitted peak outright violence, but I guess that depends on who you ask. The people of Hong Kong or the Falun Gong would probably disagree with me. This shift in feeding on itself is evident in the comments made by megalomaniacs such as Bernie Sanders or AOC, for example. Quote, "The billionaire class is scared, and they should be," end quote, Bernie Sanders. Comments as such can only come from parasites who have never produced anything and can only subsist via the expropriation of the production of another. This is only possible in a system where the instrument through which we measure economic value is the sole privilege of the state. But this is now changing. The separation of money and state is being driven by the individual who now has the technological capacity and the monetary ability to become more autonomous, independent, sustainable, and yes, more sovereign than they have ever before been. Whilst the peak of the state may have come 20 years ago, the shift is ongoing. It will not happen overnight. Prior shifts have taken multiple generations, if not multiple centuries, to occur, and although today progress is much faster, we still have a ways to go, and it's not going to be a smooth ride. Paradigm shifts happen in a tumultuous fashion. They are, by definition, both constructive and destructive simultaneously. Change in the real world is a complex process. Whilst new structures are being built, old structures are coming down, and it will not be smooth. It will not be orderly. It will not be fair, and it will not be equal. That's for damn sure. Your bullshit Keynesian neoclassical economic and social theories cannot forecast shit, and can do less to make for a smooth landing or elegant deleveraging. Sorry, Ray, not likely. Those who will be most rewarded will, as always, include the lucky. The world abounds with fools of randomness, e.g. Roger Ver, along with the prepared, curious, and those hungry for knowledge. It's those who get off their asses and dig deeper than the surface who will be best positioned to be on the constructive side of this shift, whilst the lazy, incompetent, ignorant, arrogant, and of course, unlucky, will likely find themselves on the destructive. Something is rotten in the state of Denmark. William Shakespeare. The Romans experienced it. So did the church. Shakespeare wrote a play about it almost 500 years ago. There comes a point when the state, or the empire, or the collective, simply starts to rot. When corruption, rent-seeking, politics, and all form of non-organic bureaucratic meddling begin to define the function of the very structure that was initially designed for its constituents' prosperity, you know the end is nigh. In modern times, the beacon of prosperity has been capitalism. In fact, ruthless free market capitalism is the mechanism of human collaboration that most closely resembles nature. Power laws, recursive network effects, complex inputs and outputs that are allowed to reach equilibrium of their own accord, rewards and punishment through inherently system-based incentives, and of course, luck. One can draw parallels to these attributes in all natural systems that have evolved over thousands, millions, and billions of years. So, what went wrong with capitalism? How the hell did we wind up with a crony version of capitalism that has rot to the core? I'll explain below, but it can be summed up in the following quote by Michael Hopf. Quote, "Hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men. And weak men create hard times." End quote. Michael Hopf. Over time, we humans seem to repeatedly stray from founding principles. Our forebears, growing up in better times, forget why some decisions were initially made. It's worse when those forebears realize they can also run a monopoly over the core resource of the time. The church had a monopoly on the written word in education, information. Capitalism and science broke that. The state today has a monopoly on money. Bitcoin is breaking that. So, why the rot? Productive or parasitic? In life, likely on planet Earth and anywhere else there may be life, there are two ways to earn a, quote, living. One, production. To produce, one must trade their time and energy in the form of effort, talent, skill, and labor, and be rewarded with property, either in the form of currency, money, or in the form of another instrument you deem valuable and commensurate to your work. 2. Theft. To steal, you make someone else's property your own, without their permission. You take what you want, whether through lying, cheating, or most often, as evidenced throughout history, the act of violence. German sociologist Franz Oppenheimer calls one, production, the economic means by which we build wealth. Economic because there is an additive and multiplicative effect that occurs as a result of the collaborative efforts of the constituents of a society who produce and then trade their property, and thus both prosper. Oppenheimer called the other, mutually exclusive method, the political means. Political because it is not concerned with the production of new goods or property, but exists and persists through the seizure, appropriation, taxation, and theft of said goods and property in the name of the collective. Once again, this fundamentally parasitic nature seems to come to a head every 500 years, if you accept the analysis of Davidson and Rees-Mogg's work in The Sovereign Individual. So where are we now? Understanding which system is dominant in the paradigm within which we are currently operating is important and useful. Modern times. I recently had a conversation with a friend who I would consider centrist or moderately conservative in nature, if those labels even mean anything anymore. She pointed out that centrally managed states such as the Scandinavian countries are the, quote, happiest in the world today based on the latest statistics and surveys. Now, whilst those surveys are laughable at best, let's just assume that there's a grain of truth in there. The problem with this, quote, fact is that the happiness is being measured during the largest monetary inflation in the history of humanity. It's a facade. And those who are high on this fake happiness are going to feel it the worst as their world crumbles thanks to the bloated social structures that cannot subsist in a new economic reality that is fast approaching. Furthermore, these, quote, happy people sacrifice their liberty and personal sovereignty for the illusion of peace via the benevolence of their leaders, who would very quickly justify behaving more like dictators should dire economic circumstances warrant such actions. And don't for a minute think, quote, it'll never happen, because it is happening now. Former IMF managing director and now head of the ECB, Christine Lagarde, recently came out with the following gem, quote, isn't it true that ultimately we have done the right thing to act in favor of jobs and of growth rather than the protection of savers, end quote. Implying that people should be grateful for their jobs, whether their savings were protected or not. Translation, quote, you should be grateful for your master gives you the right to be a slave, end quote. Are you kidding me? The very notion of paying an institution just to store your money, well, not really your money, or being paid to borrow money is utterly absurd, but is slowly being pushed upon us in the West as not only necessary to stimulate the heroin junkie of an economy we now have, but it's being called normal. Even Dalio is waking up. Quote, as a result, rich capitalists will increasingly move to places in which the wealth gaps and conflicts are less severe, and government officials in those losing these big taxpayers will increasingly try to find ways to trap them. End quote. Ray Dalio. And it's not just economic madness. Bernie Sanders, whom I mentioned earlier, is a brilliant example of an old fool espousing a nice-sounding veneer of an ideology with incredibly dangerous roots. Maybe he was inspired. Quote, it is difficult for me to imagine what personal liberty is enjoyed by an unemployed person who goes about hungry and cannot find employment. Real liberty can exist only where exploitation has been abolished, where there is no oppression of some by others, where there is no unemployment and poverty, where a man is not haunted by the fear of being tomorrow deprived of work, of home, and of bread. Only in such a society is real and not paper, personal and every other liberty possible. End quote. Sounds nice, right? That same person went on to say, quote, when we hang the capitalists, they will sell us the rope we use. End quote. Yep. That same person went on to rule the regime that gave us gulags, famine, deportations, massacres, forced disappearances, extrajudicial killings, torture, and was responsible for not only the deaths of millions of people, but the utter oppression of tens of millions more over the ensuing decades. That person was Joseph Stalin. Although you may for a moment have thought it was Bernie. Stalin was, in the early days, viewed as the man who would help the lower class and poor people fight back against the so-called oppressive capitalists. Little did those poor people, pun very much intended, realize they would be accepting a modern form of serfdom. Little did they know how dire the ramifications of such an ideology would be. And here we are, barely a generation since the goddamn Berlin Wall came down, at it again. This time from the likes of Bernie Sanders, AOC, and Elizabeth Warren, all who want to walk in the shoes of Chairman Mao, Lenin, or Stalin himself. This tweet came out just as I was finishing up this piece, and I had to include it. Bernie Sanders, quote, "Say Bill Gates was actually taxed $100 billion. We could end homelessness and provide safe drinking water to everyone in this country. Bill would still be a multi-billionaire. Our message? The billionaire class cannot have it all when so many have so little." End quote. Of course, Bernie would surely know how to deploy that capital. To his cronies, to the military, to bullshit social programs that don't work, and in every other non-functional, malinvested, misappropriated fashion. Bernie's next book, How to Burn $100 Billion and Achieve Nothing. Bernie Sanders is merely the modern-day equivalent of prior socialist leaders, who embodies the political means of wealth, confiscation, via the power to rob whoever he deems as unworthy. Welcome to the slippery slope that leads to communism and enslavement. The only way to maintain such a system is via violence or the threat of said violence. That's not freedom. That's slavery. And no man, woman, or child should have to live in a world like that. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Ignorance is strength. This is the path of collectivism. One of my favorite lines from Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged surmises Hamlet's quote, the headline of this section, perfectly. Quote, "Money is the barometer of a society's virtue. When you see that in order to produce, you must seek permission from those who produce nothing. When you see money is flowing to those who deal not in goods, but in favors. When you see that men get richer by graft and by pull, not by work. When your laws protect the looters more than the consumer, you will know that your society is doomed." End quote. Ayn Rand. Piercing the veil. Bitcoin's promise to help bank the unbanked was not to do so by giving them a payments technology. It was to do so by giving them a money via which they have property rights. Those who live in nations that don't respect, recognize, or value personal property are those who have the most freedom to gain. Those of us in the West who are watching the state ever so slyly repeal our property rights have a twofold motivation to participate in this revolution. A. We are able to escape the grip of a modern, technologically empowered iron fist which continues to squeeze. And B. We ride a rocket ship to the proverbial moon because we had the balls, foresight, insight, vision, or dumb luck to get in early. It's A that I'm personally more interested in, though, perhaps due to my personal libertarian bent, or because it's something I derive a greater sense of meaning from. Likely both. Now, you might say that, hey, you're exaggerating. We're pretty good here in the West. We have stable social structures, good property rights, and yeah, while taxes might be high, that money goes to use. We live a pretty good life. By and large, I would agree. But I would urge you to look beyond the veil. The central banking cartel and crony capitalist governments of the West have reached a point in history where they can no longer sustain their structure without squeezing their subjects harder. And they know it. The signs are evident, as described above. Furthermore, look around. These same stable governments continue to strip away our freedoms via absurdities such as the anti-encryption laws in Australia, anti-cash laws, draconian follow-you-everywhere tax laws, inability to travel freely, panopticon surveillance, increased law enforcement powers, speeding ticket optimization frameworks. You can't drive around for 10 minutes in Sydney without seeing a cop hiding around the corner ready to book you for blinking. And even new laws empowering their agents to force you to divulge your private information, e.g. decrypting your drives coming to New Zealand. It's madness. Ayn Rand was so poignant once again. Quote, "Laws are designed to be broken, not observed. When you're after power, there's no way to rule innocent men. The only power any government has is the power to crack down on criminals. And when there isn't enough criminals, one makes them. One declares so many things to be a crime that it becomes impossible to live without breaking laws. Who wants a nation of law-abiding citizens? There's nothing in that for anyone. But pass the kind of laws that cannot be observed, followed, or objectively interpreted, and you create a nation of criminals and lawbreakers. Then you cash in on guilt. That's the system." End quote. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. Descartes. Descartes said this almost 500 years ago, during the last major transformation in human history, the fall of the dominance of the church and the rise of the merchant and science-enabled state. Much has been said about this recently, particularly in the Bitcoin circles. I'm sure all the crypto people are going to try to hijack this soon too, but let it be known here that Bitcoin has been about this from the beginning. The parallels drawn between the events of the Gunpowder Revolution, the Renaissance, early banking, the rise of the merchant, and the fall of the prominence of the church, to today's technological revolution, private, self-sovereign banking, the rise of the sovereign individual, and the fall of the state, are eerie. Descartes' words have never been so profound. The words, "I think" and "I am," are the genesis of the self. Yes, we are all made of the same stuff, but it's that unique combination of stuff that makes us who we are. The sanctity of the individual is paramount. Tony Robbins has a profound quote. Quote, "The most powerful force in the human spirit is the desire to stay consistent with its identity." End quote. To say "I am" is a claim to one's identity and independence. It's a claim to one's personal sovereignty, which we can now do so like never before, thanks in large part to Bitcoin. How, you may ask? Our work is our labor. Our labor is our time and our energy. When we boil it down, they are all we have, and all we are truly made up of. To live, to love, to work, to travel, to experience, to remember, to plan, to do anything requires two things, time and energy. We can only effectively measure these through a unit that we can all agree best represents time and energy. As you'll learn in this publication, money is that unit. And for the first time in history, we have a version that can do the job without being compromised. It is why Bitcoin is the ultimate tool for personal sovereignty, and the catalyst that leads us to a future more like Star Trek and less like Terminator. Incorruptible property rights. All right, let's take a break right here and hit our sponsor. We're most of the way through this piece. We've only got a little bit left, but I don't think I'm going to have time for commentary because there's still a lot of other things that I need to get to, and I just got something new dropped on my plate about 10 minutes ago. So let's go ahead and hit our sponsor, and then we'll finish this piece out. Incorruptible property rights. Bitcoin provides a stable system of property rights without reliance on the state. With it, individuals can be truly self-sovereign. The mathematical primitive of strong, open-source, modern-day cryptography gives us, for the first time in history, a method whereby the sanctity of personal property and the act of sacrificing for the future can be maintained without the requirement for the protection or oppression of the state, the church, the monarch, the feudal lord, nor the tribal leader. In modern times, and in the future that lay before us, human beings, and potentially machines alike, will be able to save the product of their labor and delay gratification, the very building blocks of society, on their own terms. As this multiplies and we are collectively empowered to take back our personal sovereignty via what is likely the greatest gift to humanity since we became conscious, we have the rare opportunity to define a new form of local and global cooperation that is voluntarist and nonviolent in nature. Bitcoin's core opt-in or opt-out nature, its open access, and its absolute nonchalance or disregard of who or what you are is the basis of this new era we now embark on. Bitcoin has chosen to not only forego the requirement of the state, but has chosen to do this via the irrefutable conversion of time and energy into a visible, verifiable network and unit. Through math, it will help us reinvent the notion of what we humans define as state. Cash is the ultimate tool of the sovereign individual. And in an increasingly digital world, the apogee is a peer-to-peer electronic cash. Cash is the ability to transact freely. And by freely, I mean, quote, to do so in a manner uncensored, direct, and final. That was traditionally only able to be done physically in the real world. Now it's able to be done digitally. Ineptitude on display in the crypto community, for example, Roger Ver and his Bcash cronies, think free means no cost. They're unable to understand that costlessness can only mean one of two things. One, it has no value, i.e. the very definition of costlessness is something with no value. Or two, it has value, in which case cheap and free means there is a cost elsewhere, a cost that is most likely draconian in nature. They think trending toward a centralized payment system for free internet transactions is what is meant by cash. That's not the freedom cash gives. Roger clearly got lucky buying Bitcoin. Dumb luck for the ultimate fool of randomness. Bitcoin and banking the unbanked was never about cheap payments. It was about giving everyone an incorruptible, uncensorable tool for economic prosperity. Bitcoin was, is, and always will be a tool for personal sovereignty. That's what was meant by cash, which of course Satoshi could not be so blatant and brazen about it back in 2008, lest Bitcoin be left in the dustbin of history alongside other crazy ideas. He let the protocol and its inherent nature do the talking. He then chose to walk away, and in doing so let loose something no amount of violence can destroy, and no amount of tyranny can control. The rest is history, and it's in the making. Conclusion. We live in a world where our rights are slowly being encroached upon, our privacy is slowly being repealed, and our freedom to truthfully express ourselves is being censored, whether due to deranged political correctness on one side, or maniacal authoritarian rule on the other, e.g. China. Bernie and those of his ilk, whether due to incompetence, stupidity, or just being a part of what Taleb calls the intelligentsia, believe in treating the symptoms by introducing more interventionist inputs into an already complex system that's slowly spinning out of control. This will never work and will only serve to send society to a real-world hell. The only way to fix up the fuckery of the current system is to start again. We must embrace the essence of Kali, cut out the cancer, and burn it all down. The time for negotiations has come to an end. Libertarians have tried this to no avail, for playing within the confines of the old paradigm is no way to bring about a new one. The battle for the future is now, and the front lines are where Bitcoin meets the fiat-denominated state. This is a war, and the stakes are higher than they've ever been. Money is the lifeblood of society. It is wealth at the very core of what the word means. He who controls it controls all of society. The introduction of free markets was the catalyst for the separation of church and state. The creation of free money is the catalyst for the separation of money and state. And more than that, it's also a stake in the heart of today's state, which has decayed to the point that its primary function is to leech, take, suck dry, and confiscate your wealth. Today, it exists no longer to protect you and serve you, but to subdue you. You are once again its subject. You can see this just by looking at the language used for a group who are supposed to be protecting you. Law enforcers. When did I agree to pay someone to enforce laws upon me, which I neither agreed to in the first place? The state's control of money is its locus of power. Through this tool, it is able to enforce its will over every facet of our lives. We, the Bitcoiners of last resort, on the front line, are here to destroy that. Bitcoin is our chance. It allows us to take the most important tool of human collaboration, i.e. money, aka the ultimate resource, and make it uninflatable, uncensorable, unconfiscatable, and all in all, unfuckwithable. By removing it from the purview of the state, we 1. Starve the state of its ability to perpetuate its parasitic existence, and 2. Get a chance to design a new form of collective collaboration in which personal sovereignty comes first, where the constituents of a society are treated like customers and the state, or social collective, is organized by means of POLA, Principle of Least Authority. Excerpt. According to Locke, we ought to part with no more of our rights to life, liberty, or property than is necessary for government to preserve those rights from each other. Quote, the right to do whatever one thought fit to preserve oneself is given up to be regulated by society, so far forth as the preservation of himself and others shall require. When any rights are given up, it is only within an intention in everyone to better preserve himself, his liberty, and his property. End quote. A corollary is that government officials ought not to be given more power to take away those rights than is necessary for government to fulfill its role of the preservation of those rights addressed by the statute. At a constitutional scale, the principle of least authority is reflected in the enumeration of powers and in the Tenth Amendment. Under a Lockean interpretation, the federal government was given certain enumerated powers only in order to protect life, liberty, and property. These enumerated powers gave the federal government no more authority over life, liberty, or property than it needs to protect life, liberty, and property. Other powers, where more local decisions protect rights better, should be retained by the states, or by smaller groups, or by individuals, the ultimate source of all such authority. The Ninth Amendment is a mirror image of the Tenth, whereas the enumeration of powers should restrict the federal government to the least authority required to execute those powers. The enumeration of individual rights is open-ended. To coin a phrase, a principle of most rights against governments consistent with protecting the life, liberty, and property of others. End excerpt. The cornerstone of all of this is personal sovereignty and liberty, and this is only possible with Bitcoin. It's only possible when the economic unit has personal, private property rights built into its very being. To paraphrase Winston from 1984 once again, the only thing Big Brother didn't have control over was what goes on in your head and your heart. Bitcoin transforms money into a unit that is fundamentally information, and information is both nowhere and everywhere. It's both inside of us and all around us, and when we ourselves know the combination that gives us personal access to that information, money, it's ours in the deepest sense of private property. Libertarians, Austrian economists, and the natural economists before them had it right. Only it was never practical in a world in which the unit of economic measurement could be owned or managed by an organization, government, collective, or state of any kind. But money has now become an unforgeable form of data that no one can control or manipulate, built on a network which nobody needs permission to build products and services on. This foundation allows us to build an entirely new world, not just a financial one, but a new form of society. So let us come together. Bitcoin is now here. Money is the battlefront. This is where the battle lines are drawn. No fucking blockchain. Money. It's the resource. And we're all going to have to pick a side. Bitcoin is now here. This is the new counterculture. This is what it means to be yourself. To be who you are. To do what you were born for. To be truly sovereign. It's scary, but it's liberation in all its glory. By Alex Fetsky, October 2019. The Rise of the Individual by Alex Fetsky to close out the Bitcoin Times second edition. I highly recommend following Alex Fetsky on Twitter. I will have the links to all of that. The little excerpt, which I didn't actually say towards the end about according to Locke, that he said is pretty sure it's attributed to Nick Szabo, but there's not like a direct a link to it, so I'm not exactly sure where it comes from. But there's a lot of great stuff. I really wish I had time to really dig into this and kind of talk about all of these aspects, because there's a lot covered in this piece. And but I do just want to say, I thought one of the really cool things that made me stop and have to like just copy and paste it is that fundamental aspect. He talks numerous times about money being the resource and how Bitcoin is a shift in money. It's the move to separate money and state, and there is a huge paradigm shift happening, and we definitely are reaching the point that the state cannot grow any further without really choking its citizens and or subjects, really. And that the act of, this is part of the quote here, is that the cryptography has given us for the first time in history a method whereby the sanctity of personal property and the act of sacrificing for the future can be maintained without the requirement for protection or oppression by a state, church, monarch, feudal lord, tribal leader, etc. Here I'm going to have to recommend once again The Sovereign Individual, that book. Really, really got to listen to that one. I haven't listened to the audiobook, but I'm very excited. I'm going to be going through it probably in the next day or two. I'm going to start into it really hard. But when you look, this is one of the most profound elements of a sound money, what it means and what it enables. It's about property rights, yes, but property rights are the foundation for progress. When you look at economics from first principles, the only way to better your life, the only way to improve your position, is to store production and value for the future. And that's the quote, the act of sacrificing for the future can be maintained. And the accumulation of that capital is exactly what allows you to increase your station, to increase your standard of life. And only by sacrificing this value today, only by not consuming some of it today and having it available tomorrow, is that possible. There's no alternative here. This is fundamental to progress and the nature of scarce resources and production in general. Like this is because we are alive, physics is a thing, and things are real. There is no way around this. Any perceived economics that gets around this with a free lunch or stimulating production through printing money or whatever it is just stealing it from somewhere else that's harder to see. That's all it does. It just covers it up and moves the problem to a different location. And what is happening with the corruption, with the prostitution of our money for political gain, is that our savings is confiscated. That Lagarde bragged about doing is it's to revoke that right. that you don't have the right to make your future better because you don't own anything that you produce. Your extra labor, which you sacrifice, which was your blood, sweat, and tears, your skills, your purpose, your meaning, the reason you were here, what you did this for to make your life, your family better, was wasted, was stolen and spent on a war, some jackass bureaucrat, $150,000 in booze for Nancy Pelosi's plane, the $3.1 billion spent on federal employees' vacations after being spent on administrative leave, after being put on administrative leave. There's a article not too, well, it was a long time ago, but I'd bumped into it not too long ago, was about DEA agents, how it's impossible to fire them, and that DEA agents who were actually caught having sex with prostitutes and going to a sex party, which was funded by the Colombian cartels for them, they got caught doing this and ended up with bonuses. None of them got fired. Apparently in 10 years, 71 DEA agents have gotten fired out of like 10,000 employees. So anyway, yeah, at least we're supporting jobs, right? But this is the nature of a confiscatory institution. If an institution survives on the right to steal from you, whether it's through the corruption of money or through taxation, there's no way to fix it. It is fundamentally broken. There's no way to create an institution of morality that exists fundamentally on the necessity to destroy that morality. Like, its core piece that makes it a state versus some other institution is to reject property rights. There's no way to protect property rights. Like, the John Locke piece, I can't get around the contradiction. I don't even care, in trying to figure out, I want to believe, I want to be believing the truth of what is really possible out there, and why the state exists, what is its role in society, because it's absolutely parasitic. That's the way it is funded is parasitic by nature. There's no denying it. You can say that parasite is necessary for some reason to create some sort of a societal standard for behavior. That's fair, but you can't not call it a parasite. Then you're just lying to yourself. And I'll get that when you tell people taxation is theft. They're like, no, it's not. We all agreed. Yeah, that's not how that works. But regardless, so let's say there is some sort of a role. I want to know what produces the best prosperity, the best incentives, the moral society. How do we actually achieve that? And it seems unrealistic to say that without a government, that everything will just fall into place, that the standards will emerge. It seems like a cop-out. But at the exact same time, I cannot get around the moral contradiction of creating a moral society, of creating a progressive and growing society that is based on contradicting those morals, that is at its foundation only possible because you are rejecting the morals. There's no way to reach that end. And he talks about how, I'm out of time. The talking to his minarchist or a slightly conservative a friend, I think it was like centrist and slightly conservative friend, about, well, you know, things are pretty great here, right? And things in the West aren't so bad. Life is pretty good. We have a lot of freedoms. And I think that's absolutely right in our current state of things because we're not having to pay the bill yet. We are to some degree. But we're still drunk. We don't have the hangover yet. We're still just getting more wasted at the party. But that's rejecting the reality of our situation and that these things are trends. And that's what's dangerous and frightening, is our trend is clearly in one direction right now. We are clearly becoming more socialist, and particularly the culture is just completely dismissive. If there's a decent political excuse to do something, to steal $100 billion from Bill Gates and just think that that's gonna solve homelessness and hunger, are you kidding me? $100 billion? We spent an extra $1 trillion this year. Did any of it get fixed? Anybody who believes the government could steal another $10 trillion and solve any of those problems is really naive. Just the orchestration of figuring out who all the homeless people are and who all the poor people are is an impossible task for that institution. It's not as if they've just got the email and phone number of all the homeless people and they could just be like, hey, dude, don't worry. We got you now. We got you. We stole all of Bill Gates' money. And for now, we'll leave out the fact that Bill Gates' money is in a company. It's not as if he's sitting on $1 billion in cash sitting in his basement or something. It's in the valuation of the stock of the companies that he owns and is a productive part of. Which means if you're taxing him $100 billion, you're getting him to break apart and sell off Microsoft. Which means that we no longer have Microsoft computers. We now have the whole foundation of that entire platform and productive ecosystem is completely crumbled. We will lose $500 billion in value to tax him $100 billion. Absolutely, because we'll lose in a massive productive enterprise that's employing hundreds of thousands of people, probably. I don't even know what the number would be. It's like saying, you know, I'm having a hard time putting food on my table, so what we're going to do is we're going to break apart the house and sell it for pieces, and then we'll be fed and everything will be great and fine. It's like, well, no, now I don't have a roof over my head. But this all fundamentally has been what I can't get around, what I can't logically escape, is the inherent contradiction to an institution that intends to create a moral cooperative society by violating the morals and being uncooperative, being explicitly violent about how it is funded, about how it exists, the foundations of why it exists. Taxation. Otherwise, it's not a state. Otherwise, it's just a company, it's two people cooperating voluntarily. But Bitcoin really throws a wrench in this whole thing because it can actually guarantee a form of property rights without the state, without taxation. Totally voluntarily, Bitcoin is able to produce an alternative system of property rights to the state and judicial protocol stack. I mean, essentially, that's what these things are. It's a protocol of human behavior and interaction, defined loosely and often very subjectively by pieces of paper, in which we adhere to and force everyone else to adhere to, rather than allow participation in if it succeeds. But it is a protocol for how we deal with situations and problems and certain confrontations. And of course, fund certain institutions and parts or services in society. And unfortunately, that means of funding has inherently no pushback, no way to actually fix it when something goes wrong. There's no reverse mechanism. It's really what we have in crony capitalism as well as the underlying what's left over in the economy of it, where we socialize losses and privatize profits, which only works to negate the critical market function of weeding out shitty services, of weeding out corruption, of weeding out waste, and producing efficiency in the long run, because losses are paid for by the people who are responsible for them, who made the decisions that led to them. No matter how unlucky they are, and no matter how much it sucks in the short term, the only way to, you must have that in place to produce a long-term sustainable society. And it might look great still right now, but the trend is in the wrong direction. If the trend is one step in the wrong direction every month or every day, then eventually you find yourself at an end, at the conclusion of this, in the worst possible situation, and you wonder how the hell we got here. Everything was so great, and we only just sort of moved in that direction. It was never obvious. Was, you know, the just like yesterday's article, as long as the water boils slowly. So this, and that's what's beautiful about this thing, and what makes it a revolution, and what makes it such a such an it's such an important technology in today's age is that we have the opportunity to A, produce that economic contraction that has been needed to wipe out all of this corruption and waste, and B, compete. We have the ability to compete with, we have a system of property rights, of ensuring property rights, no matter how limited. You know, it is just money, but money is the ultimate resource, so it is essentially all resources to some degree. I mean, granted, it's not going to protect your house if the government comes after your house or a oppressor comes after your physical station and family and all your other goods, but that there is a thing that you can have independently, that there is a form of property that you can have regardless of your jurisdiction and actually maintain your privacy with. Like, that's a breakthrough. That is a fundamental game changer. That's not working within the rules of the previous game that has become corrupted and bloated. That's changing the nature of the game and starting from scratch, starting at the beginning, starting back at first principles and building something new to actually solve the systemic problem, not take another pill to cover up the symptom, which is what we are constantly doing. So more than anything, Bitcoin is just an unbelievable opportunity, but we still have to fix it. We still have to build this thing. We still have to make sure it stands up. We still have to ensure that Bitcoin continues to provide that service, provide that value. And I don't think that comes from naively assuming that it's always going to work that way. It's going to come from treating it as if it can be killed and that we got to figure out what that way is. We have to be Bitcoin's greatest enemy into how to destroy this thing so that we can fix all of those holes. And I think we have the right, at least the development and engineering mindset in this community and in the developers behind this. But it is, this is, if we screw this up, it's our own damn fault. But we've got the greatest opportunity imaginable sitting in our lap, and I hope we treat it with the respect it deserves. I gotta say, though, now that we've come to the end of this, I gotta get out of here anyway. But a huge thank you for the Bitcoin Times second edition, for this article by Alexander Spetsky, for everything that Alexander has done in this publication and bringing this out. It really is amazing. It's so much fun to read, and all of these pieces were great. Be sure to drop some massive applause. Do not forget to follow Timeless Bitcoin. Go to bitcointimes.news. Check all of these guys out. Follow everybody. Subscribe to this. Get your own PDF version and keep an ear out. Make sure you're following so that you don't miss it when they do the limited run of the physical copy, because if I am any barometer here, I think this is going to be a great collectible to have on your wall or in your Bitcoin collection, just stashed away for that day when Bitcoin has hugely changed the world and you get to brag about being an OG when back in the day this came out, when everybody was still calling it a joke and nobody understood what was really happening. Here's my copy. So I'm going to try to get one, and I highly recommend it. So thank you guys so much for listening. I got a piece, and you won't know all the usual shit that I say at the end of the show. Become a patron if you want to join the crew. Share this out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space. I love you all, and let's build the future we want. Until next time, take it easy, guys. We'll be right back.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.